And we all know that feeling when you're forcing yourself to pay attention to something. That's where 3 minutes or 10 minutes or 20 minutes or whatever, there starts to be this limit to how long somebody can force themselves to focus. And so what we want to do is create environments where they're not forcing themselves, where there's a natural task they're trying to accomplish. It doesn't feel as forced. You don't have to compel yourself to focus. And then it's much easier to maintain intention over longer periods of time.
This is the ERP Organizational Change Journal podcast, brought to you by Nessel and Associates, a Newport Beach, California-based ERP organizational change management firm serving the private equity industry. The ERP OCJ seeks to share expertise, insight, experience, and research, and to create effective conversation to help guide ERP organizational change to real, measurable, and verified success. And now, here's your ERP expert and host, the founder of Nessel & Associates, Dr. Jack Nessel.
Hey, Jack here. Today we're going to dive into a fundamental and key notion to ERP organizational change success, organizational learning. In this episode, our guests will share some insights into the basic learning principles, learning behaviors, and tactical actions to support organizational learning. We will discuss ERP success, learning strategy, and behavior with Julie Dirksen. Julie is an expert in instructional design, e-learning, and behavior change. She's a frequent speaker at industry events, the author of one of the best-selling books on instructional design, and an e-learning guildmaster. She's an independent consultant and instructional designer with more than 15 years of experience creating highly interactive e-learning experiences for clients from Fortune 500 companies and technology startups to grant-funded research initiatives. Her book is Design for How People Learn, and we'll include the link in our show notes. Joining us from Milwaukee today, Julie, welcome to the show.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
Really looking forward to this, Julie. And thanks again for your time and sharing your insight with our listeners. Before we start, can you further introduce yourself to our listeners?
Yeah, I am an instructional designer is usually how I identify, although I do more things at the strategy level than actually producing learning experiences these days. But I was realizing as you're reading the bio, I'm like, that's the bio I gave him. And it's getting closer to like 25 years now than to 15 years. That's how long that bio's been kicking around. So I need to update things. And I've spent most of my time in adult corporate and workplace environments doing instructional design and training and learning and development for those organizations. But I also have some other background that is useful. One framework I come from is I spent about half of my time in grad school over learning what we now call user experience design. At the time, it was still human-computer interaction, but really looking at the question of how does technology enable performance? What do we need to change about systems in order to help people succeed? And I feel like that's a really good mix that often gets kind of separated out. There's either we're either trying to fix the person or we're trying to fix the system. Yeah. If you're an instructional designer, you're trying to fix the person. If you're UX, you're trying to fix the system. And I feel like we really should be talking to each other more because I think the goals are very similar. And then as you mentioned, the sort of area of expertise that I'm really focused on right now is behavior change. In fact, that's going to be the next book is going to be on how do we bring a lot of lessons in from the behavioral sciences and apply them in learning and development environments.
Well, how interesting. Wow. And fascinating topic. Well, I can't wait to dive in here, Julie. So before we get started, just a note here. What we do know is for large-scale ERP organizational change, organizational leadership can take advantage of learning from others, whether in practice or research. And one thing that we do know from research is that team learning behaviors may have had a significant and consistently positive effect on team performance and hence ERP success. And research also suggests that intentionally creating cultures of inquiry in which organizational stakeholders engage in learning with the intent of improving their processes and practices is a significant benefit. And furthermore, some research suggests that in a positive culture of inquiry and learning, employees should be left to feel that communication does not equate to criticism. To promote a culture of inquiry and learning, it's important to understand how the manager perceives, values, and promotes questioning and learning. So let's learn more about this topic with Julie.
Yeah. So one of the things whenever I'm in an organization, and I'm usually, I do a lot of instructional design workshops, so I'm often in organizations to help them level up their instructional design practices. And one of the things I've started to look for in different organizations is learned helplessness. And if people aren't familiar with the learned helplessness research, it's a really interesting area. It's Marty Seligman and others worked on that. And the initial experiment is a little dodgy. They took a dog and they put it on a plate where it was getting kind of, hopefully fairly mild electric shocks. But it was getting unpleasant shocks, but the dog couldn't escape from the enclosure. And eventually the dog will stop trying to escape. And then they can actually open up the enclosure and the dog will just sit there and continue to get shocked because it's learned that it doesn't matter what they do. This is just its life now and it's happening to them, which is horrible research. And you should never do that to dogs. But one of the things that I tend to look for when I go into organizations is whether or not they've got a certain degree of learned helplessness about change in the organization. So if I go in and I say, hey, here are some design strategies, and they say, oh, we tried that and it didn't work, or we tried that and managers wouldn't support it, or we tried that and users wouldn't do it, or we wanted to do that, but IT wouldn't let us, or we wanted to do that, but they wouldn't give us budget, you know, things like that. And you, every time you talk about some potential innovation or some potential change, they have some reason why, you know, based on real experience. I don't want to make it sound like they're just being kind of grumpy, but they have actually had the negative feedback loop on this where, you know, when they've tried to do certain things in the past, the organization has not supported it. And the tough thing about that is even if you get management in that's committed to changing that and things like that, people are not going to believe it until they actually have the opposite experience.
Yeah.
And so a big part of that is kind of how do you create, you're not just how do I reinforce change, but how do I create situations where people believe that changes, you know, positive changes are going to be reinforced? Because the thing about it is it sounds like they've given up, and, you know, that's not untrue, but at the same time, they're right. They did try to do some stuff and they did get shut down. And so when I go into organizations where I see that, I always am like, you know, my heart's a little heavy whenever I'm talking to those people. I'm like, oh, you need more than I'm going to be able to help you with in, you know, 2 days that I'm here, which is always the challenge of being that kind of, you know, that kind of engagement is, you know, when you see problems that are of much longer duration, you know. And then I've been in other organizations where the whole room is like, we can figure this out. And they, you know, they'll come up with all sorts of interesting and creative ways to problem solve around it. And you can tell that, like, this is an organization where people have been supported in those efforts. And so it really kind of comes down to if they're telling you that their experience is that they haven't been allowed to do these things in the past, you can't just tell them, no, it's okay now. They actually have to see it and experience it being reinforced before they're going to change that belief. And some organizations, a friend of mine, Carl Fast, he's he's in information architecture and things like that, brilliant guy, talks about right versus better organizations. And in right organizations, you need to be right. And if you're not right, you're going to be blamed. Right. And so if I say, I think we should do this, and then it turns out badly, you are then the scapegoat for, I mean, well, you blamed for that thing and it's bad, versus better organizations, which is, I think we should do this. We think it's better. How are we going to evaluate whether it's better? And if it's not better, we're just going to, you know, back off of that and do something else. But a better organization is fundamentally, like, even if something doesn't go well, that's data that we feed into the next iteration, not blame that needs to get attached to somebody.
Yeah.
And, you know, these are big, hard things to shift if organizations are like that. One of the things I remember, Carl told me this one, but he was like, if they say, well, you're the expert, that's not a compliment. That is, we're going to blame you if this goes badly.
Right.
And, you know, the truth is, like, expertise has limits because we live in a complex world.
Yeah.
So I sort of see expertise as, I think I can get you in the neighborhood of a plausible solution that we should test, not this is the right thing to do.
Yeah.
And I think we need to have much more of that frame of, we're going to use the best expertise we can to take the closest swing at what we think is going to work, but we're prepared to gather information and to shift gears if it turns out not to be the right thing.
Yeah.
Because I've had big, large-scale implementations of different systems in organizations where people have told me, you know, flat out, under, you know, in confidence, but flat out, like, we can't afford for this to fail. So if we're going to collect data on how well it's working, it kind of needs to support the case because there's too many reputations at stake in this initiative. And it's like, oh, that's a rough one, because that's not going to be that sort of robust culture of inquiry and building that trust that people will have around trying stuff and knowing that there's a certain amount of safety, you know, that it's safe to fail. Like that, again, that has to be experienced. Like you can't just say it is. You have to actually, the proof has to be in the pudding.
Yeah.
In Charles Duhigg's book, I think it's The Power of Habit, but it might have been Smarter, Faster, Better. He talks about a case where the CEO would deliberately walk around without his hard hat or his safety glasses or something. And if anybody could catch him doing it, he would give them $20 or something along those lines. I'm probably getting the details wrong. But the whole point of it was he was like, I'm going to model the behavior that even the CEO needs to be told to put on his hard hat, because that's how we view safety in this organization. You know, creating those opportunities for people to genuinely believe that we mean it when we say everybody has the power to challenge something that they think is being done wrong, you know, that we're in this together, that this is a collaborative thing, that you won't be punished for speaking up, you know, all of that kind of stuff. Like the proof has to be in the pudding on that one. And people have to not only be told it, but they have to genuinely have some evidence that they've experienced that they believe it.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, creating a culture of inquiry, as you'd mentioned, and a culture of being creative and innovative and being reflective is a significant organizational learning. And I think one thing I'm hearing you say, if I were to distill down your insight, is learning, you know, there's learning and then there's effective and efficient learning, right? And mm-hmm. And I think for this reason, organizations certainly benefit to reflect on their learning needs, you know, determine their learning goals, evaluate resources, evaluate progress, and then modifying their learning approaches if needed. Would you agree with that statement?
Absolutely. Yeah. I mean, I think the biggest challenge that learning and development face is that it's often really starved of feedback.
Yeah.
And we talk about feedback and evaluation like it's something that learning and development should do, but that's often really difficult because the whole organization needs to be engaged in this.
Yeah.
So you need an organization where, you know, that culture of feedback and is this working and how do we know it's working? Because often L&D is just isn't in a position to kind of collect real metrics on that or observe those things. And a lot of times, I think it was, I was just watching a thing by Rob Brinkerhoff, and he was talking about how, you know, if we drive it from a learning evaluation point of view, you're often kind of going and begging people to collect data for you, as opposed to the point of view of like, how are we supporting, you know, how are we supporting you in a business need and how are we going to know if it's working? In a way that, like, instead of I'm asking you to do me a favor, manager who's supposed to be collecting information for me on whether or not this learning program is effective, instead, how is it framed in the terms of what does this manager need to accomplish,
yeah. And
how are we working together to, you know, ensure that what we're doing is being effective and being useful?
Yeah, absolutely. And Julie, really, I think as a follow-up, can you describe for our listeners this idea of instructional gap analysis? And you actually mentioned in your book, it's as a, quote, systematic framework for breaking down a learning challenge and selecting appropriate and effective learning strategies. In fact, Julie, in your book, I believe in chapter one, entitled Where Do We Start? You share that, quote, if learning is a journey, that's the gap between where they are and where they need to be. Sometimes the gap is knowledge, but just as often the gap can be skills, motivation, habit, and environment. Can you share with our listeners a little more on that idea?
Yeah. So, you know, the question is if somebody's is there right now and they're not doing the thing. So maybe the thing is, making use of some functionality that exists in an ERP system or something like that. So there's some functionality that they can use to communicate or document or whatever, you know, whatever the thing is, and it's not being used right now. So asking ourselves, is the gap between where that learner is right now and where they need to be or where we would like them to be, if the objective is, you know, the learners will be able to use this functionality to effectively document XYZ. Is it just knowledge? You know, is it just they need to know that that function exists and how it works, in which case we can explain that to them. And knowledge is the easy problem in a lot of ways because we have so many tools for disseminating it. We can send you a PDF, we can create a short video, we can do a webinar and show you how it works and, you know, all this kind of stuff. Getting knowledge out in the world is in many ways, I mean, I don't want to downplay it because there's an art to doing it well and a science to doing it well. But in some ways, it's the easiest problem to solve. How do I just communicate or share out this piece of knowledge or information? Sometimes, you know, I also talk about procedural gaps, which is any gap between where they are and where they need to be, where we have a really well-defined expectation of what this looks like. So for example, if the gap is they need to be able to create this report and populate it in the system, you know, that's pretty procedural in terms of steps. You click on create, and then you do this, and then you click this, and then you format it this way, and you set stuff up. And so that's pretty spelled out. Like, we know exactly what the steps are that we want somebody to do, and there's a little bit of judgment or variation, but by and large, we have pretty well-defined performance. And so those are knowledge and procedure, and that's typically where learning and development spends most of its time right now. But then there's the question of some other types of gaps. And so my gap framework is based on kind of that, the classic, which is knowledge, skills, attitude, or there's different ways to phrase it, but it's an expansion on that. And I have some pretty specific criteria that I talk about when I think about skills. So if we have really well-defined performance, we know exactly what we need people to do. I kind of refer to that as a procedure, but skills is any other situation where we really don't think people are going to be good at it unless they've practiced it. Mm-hmm. So for example, filling out a timesheet, somebody can probably get the instructions and be good at that out of the gate. They probably don't need to practice filling out their timesheet in order to be proficient at it. But if it's playing golf, you know, nobody expects that I can just sort of explain to you how to play golf and that you could go and do it well.
Right.
You know, of course, it's something that needs to be practiced. But then it's interesting because I think we understand the importance of practice for skills that are visual, like sports or music, where it has an, you know, I suppose it's auditory, but there's a clear output that we can see. You know, language learning is pretty clear, you know, anything like that. And also, we know that we don't want doctors and helicopter pilots and people driving on the road who haven't practiced before they kind of get turned loose on the world.
Right.
And so I sort of refer to this as the sports and things where you can kill people conundrum, which is we understand the importance of practice in all of those domains. But then as soon as we move a skill into the cognitive domain, we kind of forget. We think we can just tell people. So like we can send people to a 2-day class on supervisor training, and we can, you know, give people an e-learning that shows them procedurally how to fill out the performance review stuff. But if I ask people, is creating a performance review a skill or not a skill? I have a little game I'll play with when I'm teaching this, and I'll play skill, not a skill. And pretty much everybody will say, oh, it's a skill. People need practice to be good at it. Well, how often does, performance, the training on how to do performance reviews include like actually practicing crafting a feedback statement and then getting somebody to give you feedback on whether it's an effective or ineffective way to do feedback statements and kind of creating that actual practice cycle around it? I have seen a lot of training on performance reviews, and I really haven't seen that much at all. And, you know, another question that I ask to identify if we're dealing with a skill is, what's the difference between your acceptable performer and your best performer? So somebody who's meeting job requirements, you know, they're probably a solid middle grade on their performance review. They're doing it. They could do it better, but they're doing it, versus somebody who's really good at it. Like, how big is that stretch between just okay and really good? And that tells you that there's a lot of skill in that if there is a big stretch between those two, and that the kinds of things that we need to do to support that kind of learning is actually pretty different. I can't just tell you what to do. You have to see examples. You have to see probably many examples. You know, I'm really interested in the question of how many case examples do you need to see before you can start to recognize these more tacit patterns. You know, you probably need to do some differentiation between good and bad. You probably need to practice doing it yourself and get feedback from somebody who's quite good at it, who can kind of critique you on things. You know, you probably need to have some ongoing coaching around this. And so it's a very different, like, I can't just tell you the steps and send you out into the world. I have to create practice environments where you're getting effective feedback.
Yeah.
What Anders Ericsson kind of refers to as deliberate practice. He's the researcher that's behind the slightly infamous 10,000-hour rule from Malcolm Gladwell, the deliberate practice guy.
Yeah.
And so that kind of thing when you're dealing with skills. Then habits are an interesting one to me, because even if you have the knowledge, even if you have the skill, even if you have the motivation, sometimes it doesn't become a habit. I can know how to floss my teeth. I can even be pretty good at flossing my teeth. And I can really want to floss my teeth. You know, I'm like, I don't want the dentist to yell at me the next time I go to the dentist. And yet it still doesn't always formulate into a daily habit. And so what's the difference between, like, if you have knowledge, you have skill, you have motivation, and yet it's still not happening because it's just not that regular habit. What are strategies to support that? And there's a lot of nice research coming out in the habit space right now. It's being focused on quite a lot. And so there's really good stuff around how do we support habits and things like that. And then motivation is anything where it's like they know what to do, but they're still not doing it. The classic question is if they could do it, if you gave them $1 million, then it's not really a training problem at that point. It's a motivation issue.
Yeah.
And that goes into the behavior change stuff. I've got a whole laundry list of things that sit underneath that that we look at. One of the big ones being the whole, is there an environment of feedback reinforcing that behavior? Or are they actively, we say they're being reinforced, but really they're kind of being discouraged because we're telling them they need to go faster or do more, or, you know, whatever the thing is. But what's behind that? And then environment is what I was referring to kind of at the beginning around the user experience piece, which is, we've spent a lot of time and money trying to like manage recycling as an individual behavior. Can you sort your recycling? Can you figure out what you're supposed to recycle? And honestly, there's real question, you know, in the overall environmental community about this is that last mile approach of we're trying to fix it in terms of individual human behaviors. And really, this is probably an organizational problem, right? How do we create environments where people just aren't using as much plastic, and you know, manufacturers are incented to figure out things that don't create a ton of plastic in the way that they build their products or package their products or, you know, things like that. And there's only so much we can do at this very last little tail end by kind of adapting the human behavior. We really need to look at the bigger system and ask the question of what are the incentives around this much plastic being in the world? And you know, is the appropriately recycling your plastic bottles the right inflection point to invest in to try to address the problem? Or do we really need to go upstream and try to figure out some other ways to deal with it there? You know, so that's a case of environment where, you know, honestly, fixing the system is probably going to be better than fixing the user. And there's some stuff where we are reliant on fixing the user. You know, we just had the world's biggest behavior change experiment in COVID. And, you know, I realize that we've very much focused on all the places that behavior change experiment failed. But actually, it was remarkable how much behavior was changed. And it was truly remarkable how many people did adopt the behaviors, because ultimately that is a case where wearing a mask or not wearing a mask does come down to an individual behavior level. Being able to kind of like take a goal, you know, we want people to use this functionality in the ERP system to document, and then really kind of asking, you know, breaking it down in terms of that framework of what's the gap between where they are and where they need to be. And if it's not knowledge, then like telling them louder and more emphatically that they need to do something is probably not going to be the solution.
So it can be skills, motivation, habit, or environment, or organizational settings.
Yeah.
But Julie, you'd mentioned there a few times, and also in your book, you talk about this idea of design for behavioral change. Mm-hmm. Can you just maybe just drill down a little bit further on that and explain to our listeners, you know, even from a high level, what that means when you talk about design for behavioral change in the context of learning?
Right. Yeah. And basically all workplace learning is intended to change behavior, right? Otherwise we wouldn't do it. I mean, there's a few cases where maybe we are creating a nice benefit side program and teaching employees something that they're just interested in or whatever. I mean, I know that that can happen, but by and large, you know, the vast majority of the learning experiences that we're creating in organizations is geared towards some kind of changing of behavior. And a lot of it, you know, does work in terms of information or procedures to change behavior. But I'm really interested in those chewy questions of when is it really a case of they know what to do, but they're still not doing it? And then kind of unpacking the reasoning behind that. Another framework that I really like is one from Susan Mickey and her team at University College London Center for Behavior Change. And she's a model called COMBI, which is capability, opportunity, and motivation. So it overlaps somewhat with the way that I do gap analysis. But, you know, is the person capable of doing the change? Do they have the knowledge, but they also have the physical ability to do it? Do they have the opportunity? And for opportunity, we look at both what's the social environment? Does it support the change? And then what's the physical environment? Does that support the change? And then motivation, do they have reflective motivation? So do they see this as their job? Is, you know, this part of their goals? Or is it something that they have value or have ambitions about? So if you're looking at something like, you know, ERP implementation, do people view this as a genuine tool to help them do their jobs better? Do they view it as just another hassle that they have to go through that's going to get in the way of them doing their jobs while all of the stuff is going on? And so that would go to this sort of idea of reflective motivation. And then automatic motivation, which is the other category, is things like biases or habits. You know, and we know whenever we're dealing with kind of system, any kind of change, people have a lot of things that they've automated, especially around work and so forth. So there's a bunch of things that I do during the day that I do automatically without even thinking about them. And then when you change the process that people go through, they have the analogy I always use is if you're used to driving in the US on the right side of the road, and you go to one of those countries where you have to drive on the other side of the road, you have all these automatic things that don't work.
Yeah.
You know, I have to have like a no jaywalking rule when I go to London or something, because my instinct about where the cars are coming from is pretty much always wrong.
Right.
And so that's often what people are fighting. Like if I started this company and I learned this and the system's already in place and I learn it, I'm not having to battle against an old way of doing things as I learn the new thing. I'm just learning the new thing. And so that's one of the big factors that we see in a lot of these, you know, organizational change kinds of things, where it's not only that I need to be convinced this is valuable, or it's not only that I need to make an effort, but I'm actively fighting the tide of wanting to turn into the left-hand lane rather than the right-hand lane, because I have this automatic thing that is left over from the old way that things were done.
Julie, I'd like to just drill down a little bit into this idea of training for complex skills. And in fact, I know in your work and you share the idea of designing training for complex skills, and you state that using frameworks from complexity science and the science of expertise development to diagnose complex learning problems and design experiences that support complex skill management is an important part of the learning process. Mm-hmm. In fact, Julie, I know that you have some great workshops in which you discuss this idea. Can you dive a little bit deeper for our listeners? And what is this exactly? And why is that idea so important?
Yeah, there's a model from organizational development that I think it came out in the Harvard Business Review in like 2007 or 2008. And it's from Dave Snowden. The name of it is Knevin. And I think I'm pronouncing that right, but it's a Welsh word. And it's spelled C-Y-N-E-F-I-N. And he was looking at it in terms of organizational problems and, you know, responding to different challenges in organizations. And he has four primary domains in this model. And one is the idea of things that are clear or obvious or simple. But that is, again, that procedural stuff. We know exactly what you need you to do. We just need to get you to do it consistently. We've spelled this out. We've done the heavy lifting of figuring out exactly what procedures will support this. Or, you know, a lot of times we put a lot of effort into making things clear if safety is an issue. Like, you know, I'm going to have a lot of clear procedures around healthcare. I'm going to have a lot of clear procedures around, you know, flying an airplane, because we know that if we're not very clear about exactly what we need people to do, then error can creep in. And then, you know, again, scenarios where people's lives are at stake if there's too much error in the system. And so there's this domain where we're like, we've done the work. We know that this is the right answer. You know, so now we just need to get people to do this consistently. But then he talks about how there's a domain that's the complicated domain, which is, you've been, you know, working in this area for a really long time. So if a new client comes to you and says, hey, these are the challenges we're having around this, whether it's an implementation or whether it's a shift in the organization, you've immediately, like as soon as they start talking, you're starting to, you know, formulate a few ideas in your head about what you think is going on in that circumstance. Obviously, you don't want to get too far down the road of assuming that you know what the challenges are, but nonetheless, like you've seen a bunch of these, you're very familiar with it. That's why you have expertise in this domain. Yeah. Have you had that experience lately where you've been like talking to somebody new and you're hearing things that sound familiar and you're recognizing issues that they're bringing up?
Yeah. Yeah. That's pretty common for me.
Yeah. Yeah. And so that's that expertise that you have, because you've been through lots and lots and lots of examples of this stuff, is what we would refer to as that domain is the complicated domain, where because you've seen lots and lots of examples, you start to go, okay, I recognize these patterns. They're telling me their problems. These are very familiar. I'm confident we can help people with these things. Mm-hmm. But if you had to sit down and write down all the thought process that you were going through to start to formulate some of the ideas that you're going to talk to them about, it would be this really big, huge, crazy branching decision tree of stuff. Like, sure. It would be very hard for you to like write all your knowledge down about this and hand it to somebody who's completely new to the space.
Right.
So whenever we're dealing with that kind of thing, where it's like, if you've been here a long time, if you've got a lot of experience, you start to know the, recognize the patterns. That's what we refer to as the complicated domain, in that there are some right answers, but they're complicated. They've got a lot of pieces. You know, you need to have been through several examples to start to build that up. You know, when we start to think about what we need from a learning point of view to support that, it really is this idea of exposure to case examples. How can I see, you know, how can I take this new person and expose them to lots of examples in a relatively safe way so that they can start to build up their own understanding of this model and framework on how to think about things. And then there's complex domains, which is if a client comes to you and wants help with something, you're never going to say, you know, without any equivocation, like, oh, well, here's the 9 things you need to do and here's the days you need to do them on. That's not how the world works.
Yeah.
we live in a complex changing world.
Yeah.
And so you're going to have guidelines, but the truth is they're going to have to test some stuff and see what happens and bring the data back and, you know, try some things out. For example, you know, if I'm creating a product, if I'm creating an online course, which I do have some of, and I want to figure out how much should I charge for this, and I go to a pricing expert and I say, should I charge, you know, $2.99 or $3.99 for this course? They're not going to tell me a number. They're going to say, no, hang on. Here's how you do audience analysis, and here's how you do competitor analysis, and here's how you test pricing schemes out in the marketplace. And so what they're doing is they're basically saying, there isn't a right answer to this question that I can tell you, because, you know, we're in a complex world, and the right answer is going to be something that you figure out by floating some things out there, gathering data and bringing it back and analyzing it. And so it's really about points of inquiry at that point. Like, how do I try stuff out, gather data, come back, and then figure out what the next step is? And that's what Dave Snowden refers to as the complex domain, where there isn't a right answer. It doesn't matter how many of these you've seen, this expert still can't tell you the answer, because the answer is it depends. And what price we're going to charge for today may be completely different tomorrow, because Google just came out with a free version that they're handing out like candy. And, you know, all of a sudden, you know, your ability to charge thousands of dollars for a thing just went away because now there's a free version out in the marketplace.
Yeah, right.
And so, so complex is more about methods of doing, you know, methods of inquiry, methods of trying stuff, methods of trying to gather results and kind of respond to it. And so that's what you're really teaching people at that point, is then your learning environment looks more like a workshop where they're trying some stuff out on real projects and bringing it back and then doing the next thing and gathering data and seeing what works. And then chaotic is the last big domain that he talks about, which is just kind of on the ground after the earthquake hits, or after a financial collapse, or after a cyber attack, or after a global pandemic, which is this, we're going to have to make decisions faster than we can. We can't wait for all the information to come in. We have to start acting now. So how do we triage? How do we try to get certain parts of this problem back under, you know, some sense of control? How do we investigate it? What do we need to do? And so from a learning point of view, again, that's kind of triage methods, but it's also a lot of times what people need to learn, you know, in learning for those environments is how to practice operating in, you know, some kind of simulation, so that when the big panicky thing happens, they don't completely get overwhelmed by the stress of it and they can still function and operate in those environments.
Yeah.
And so depending on which of these skill domains we're dealing with, we start to have really different kinds of learning needs. So simple, it's, I just need you to know the procedures. I can hand you the thing. I can test it with multiple choice questions. It's pretty, you know, it's pretty easy and straightforward. Complicated, I need to get you exposure to lots of case examples. I need to do activities like critiques. I need to have you try to do stuff and get feedback. Complex, I need to treat it like a workshop where we're going to workshop real problems and you're going to go out into the world and gather data and come back and analyze it. And we're going to talk about, you know, inquiry strategies and ways of testing ideas. And then chaotic, I need to put you into a simulation so that you get used to the stress level of this and also teach you some concrete triage methods to handle, you know, big, difficult things that happen. And so as we look at these different domains, it helps point us towards better learning strategies when we're thinking about what kinds of learning experiences do people need to have.
So I think, Julie, as you know, as you'd mentioned, the world can be very complex. And certainly, as I think you and I know, and many of our listeners, you know, as consultants, when you go into organizations, every organization can be quite different, right? It can be quite complex as well. And I think that the key here is that there are certain principles, let's say, that may guide, as you said, sometimes you don't have the answers, but there are maybe recommended processes for maneuvering through complexities. And I think sometimes that, you know, I just one of my interests is just the idea of science and versus applied science and applied research. And I think there's a lot as practitioners to learn, you know, some of the basic fundamentals that are perhaps consistent across organizations and even complex situations and organizations. But that being said, you do talk about in some of your work, this idea of the science of attention and engagement for learning. And kind of on this note, can you maybe share some principles that you apply in your work? And I guess maybe this question is also falling into this motivational science category as well. And the idea of motivation, but can you just talk a little bit about the science of attention and engagement and maybe some of the key principles that can be applied in learning settings within organizations?
Yeah. Well, so I'll start with, if I asked you right now, how interested in a scale of 0 to 10 would you be in watching a 5-minute video on printer repair? where would you rate yourself right now?
At the moment, I'd probably be a zero.
Yeah. And that's mostly what I hear when I ask that question. Okay. So now scenario number two, your printer's broken and you need to print, you know, the tax returns or whatever to get in the mail. I don't know if anybody mails tax returns still. I'm sure some people do, but let's go with that hypothetically. You need to print your tax returns. They've got to get in the mail today. Your printer's broken. Now what's your level of interest in watching a 5-minute video on printer repair?
Oh, I'm 11 out of 10.
Yeah. Okay. All right. So third scenario is you're in a classroom in a workshop I'm teaching, and I put a broken printer in front of you. And I say, your task next in this class is to fix this printer. Okay. Where are you now on the 0 to 10 scale?
Well, I want to do good in your class, so I'm probably a 10, so I'm probably going to go watch that video.
Yeah. Okay. So, and you know, that one I get, you know, the answers to that one are like 6, 7, 8, sometimes 10, you know, that kind of thing. So pretty much everybody's zero. Every once in a while I get somebody who's like, no, I'm interested in printers. And I'm like, really? Okay. And the difference between those three scenarios is not, were those learning materials really engaging? The difference between those three scenarios was, can I do something with this information right away? It's the exact same video in all three scenarios, right? And it doesn't need to have dancing unicorns and like kittens and stuff. If I have something I need to do with it, I will probably be able to pay attention to it pretty well. And so we have this problem where we're trying to allocate attention all day long. And we're in this constant process of going, is this worth paying attention to? So in the first few minutes of this podcast, people probably said, worth paying attention to? Maybe, maybe not. And some people decided, nope. And some people were like, yeah, I'm in. But we're constantly doing that all day long. And so when we think about the cues that tell people whether or not they should pay attention to something, immediate utility is actually probably the strongest and most important one. There's other stuff, but that's a really big one. Can I do something with this right away? So then when we start to think about learning experiences, we want to ask the question of, can I create a learning experience where you can do something right away, right? So it's a lot easier if I have a broken printer in front of me, even if it's a hypothetical, even if this printer, I don't need to print anything. It's just a class. This is completely a scenario. that this broken printer is here, but you know, it's an actual thing that I can do than watching this 5-minute video on printer repair, because we have a preference for if a reward or consequence comes quickly, that's going to motivate behavior way more than if it's delayed. So a lot of times we're asking people to learn things that they can't use for a long time. Now, in the ideal world, with a lot of stuff, they learn it right before they actually need it. And so we just push the moment of learning out to, we create just-in-time resources that, you know, they, a little video that they can pull up right before they need to, you know, do the thing. The problem with that is that there's scenarios where that doesn't work. So we don't want people watching the 3-minute video on how to evacuate the building when they should be evacuating the building, you know.
Yeah,
that's not right. That's not a good answer. But you know, if it's a 3-minute video on how to run this report, and I can just wait until I need to run the report and then watch it, that's probably the best answer, rather than, hey, I'm going to make you sit through the whole explanation about how to run this report 6 months before you ever need to run this report. And so that's the most powerful, you know, indicator of attention is, can I do something with this right away? And even if they don't have a need immediately for this, if you can give people even a simulated task that they need to accomplish, their animal brain, the animal parts of their brains, we're all animals, but you know what I mean? Like, the doesn't know that it's a simulation. It's like, oh, we're doing a thing. Okay. I'm going to allocate cognitive resources to doing this thing versus I'm listening to something that I'm pretty sure I'm not going to need for a really long time. Like, that's just always going to be a tough uphill battle to get people to pay attention to that. So that's the number one thing. There's other stuff too. Like, how strongly we feel about something is probably a way that we gauge the importance of a thing. There's a neuroscience researcher, Antonio Damasio, who looks at people who have had damage to the emotional areas of their brain, and it makes them very bad decision makers, because in the absence of any kind of feeling about something, like, this just feels right to me, or I don't know, this feels a little bit, you know, things like that. We talk about those things. And so, you know, we recognize that it's important, but we sort of forget it when we're creating training materials, because we take all of the emotional context out of stuff a lot of times when we're teaching people. So I'm teaching you how to run this report, but at the same time, I'm not thinking about any of the context of that report. Is this a report that I'm going to use to determine where we might want to do some hours cuts and staffing? Or is this a report where I'm going to use it to go in and make the pitch for increased funding for it? Like, what are the emotional context? Why do I care about this? And a lot of times we're like, here's just the procedure for running this report. And it's really hard to care in those things. And when it's hard to care, it's really hard to allocate your attention. You have a brain region, the prefrontal cortex, that is the part of your brain that projects out into the future and considers consequences for stuff. But it's more recently evolved. And then we've got a much bigger part of our brain that controls emotions and physicality and, you know, perception in the world and all these kinds of things. And we all know that feeling when you're forcing yourself to pay attention to something. If you're having to force yourself to pay attention to something, so I really need to sit down and read this contract because I have to get this signed because the client's waiting for it, or I really need to sit down and compile my tax, you know, expenses for the accountant, or, you know, like, I'm leaning heavily on things that are legal or procedural or whatever, because that, you know, and we all know that feeling of forcing yourself to pay attention. And we talk about the limits to people's attention spans, but everybody's binge watching the entire season of whatever on Netflix. People can pay attention for 10 hours if they want to. What they can't probably do is force themselves to pay attention for 10 hours. So when we're forcing ourselves to pay attention, that's where these things like 3 minutes or 7 minutes or 10 minutes or 20 minutes or whatever, there starts to be this limit to how long somebody can force themselves to focus. And so what we want to do is create environments where they're not forcing themselves, where there's a natural task they're trying to accomplish. It doesn't feel as forced. You don't have to compel yourself to focus. And then it's much easier to maintain intention over longer periods of time.
Fascinating. And Julie, this is a great insight and exactly why we wanted to invite you to the podcast, because of your insight and expertise. And, you know, some of the points that you mentioned apply so well and actually apply 100% to ERP organizational change, because a lot of times, typically it's organizations, of course, and it's adult learners, but we'll start training for a go live for a new ERP system. It could be 6 months to a year in advance.
Yeah.
And, you know, you go through your scenarios and you go through what's called conference room piloting and you walk through different processes and you give them work instructions. And, you know, there's a lot there for preparation for a go live to get the team, the organizational team prepared for a go live. But a lot of the points and principles that you're discussing, you know, I actually think that in our field of ERP organizational change, that learning and development, or I should say effective learning and development, is probably one of the biggest areas of improvement in our field for successful ERP organizational change. So I think there's a lot to be learned from my field, from your field, frankly. Okay, Julie, I have a question here, and I know you talk about this a little bit in your book as well, but can you tell me more about this idea of design for social and informal learning? How does that work, and what does that look like?
Yeah, so there are people who are absolutely more expert in this area than I am, but that was one of the big additions between the first edition and the second edition of the book, because there was so much happening in that space. And that goes to this question of complexity, right? We talked about the complex domain where things are always changing. One of the problems you're always going to have whenever you're creating learning materials, any kind of learning and development materials, is you have this issue of stuff being out of date pretty much as soon as you get it documented. And so one of the ways to kind of think about that is to think about, can I have more flexible learning environments or learning tools that can be more adaptive to changing circumstances? So there's some stuff, you know, again, about like an ERP implementation or something that's pretty nailed down. Like we know that it's the same. And so then putting that into a more formal form of learning and development can be solid. So like I worked for a finance company years ago, and stuff like the formulas and the methods around calculating loan payments, or how did you explain to somebody how a loan payment was calculated? You know, that's accounting that's existed for decades, or you know, more than decades. It's not changing. And so we could invest in that and feel very confident that that material, if we made an e-learning out of it, you know, formally built that out somewhere, that that's going to be solid a year from now and 5 years from now. This stuff isn't going to change. But then you have stuff where the answer of what do we need to do, or how do we need to handle this, or what is a particular person going to need? So you get these environments that are much more variable. So it might be that the content's changing all the time as we move through the process, or it could be that what a particular person needs is changing all the time as we move through the process, or whatever. And so we look for more flexible ways of managing that. And one of the tools or strategies that you can use is kind of social or informal learning. So somebody needs to know how to do a particular thing in Articulate, which is an e-learning authoring tool. Well, the best and easiest way that they can do that is to go out to the big community around that, which is a community called eLearning Heroes, and you just ask the question and somebody is going to show up and help you with it. Or you do a quick search on the archives, because the chances are actually that like 13 other people have already asked this question and that there's good answers out there. And it doesn't have to be the official answer quite so much. You know, so obviously social informal makes people in high compliance or regulatory environments nervous, because you can have quote unquote wrong answers floating out there. And I have mixed feelings about that. In one hand, I get it. And on the other hand, it's like, well, they're still having these conversations. You just can't see them doing it if you don't create spaces for them to have the conversations. So creating opportunities for people who are dealing with the same problems to talk to each other and to share their experience and to share their insight. And for people who are, you know, at an earlier stage in the process to be able to ask questions from people who are later stage in the process. Like these are a lot of the goals that we have around social or informal learning. And then it just becomes a question of how do I support that, or how do I create some space for it, or how do I make sure that they have methods of communicating with each other? I did a project years ago for a pharmaceutical company, and it was this whole scenario-based thing around managing pharmaceutical reps and things like that. And I think the scenarios we created were good, and I think we got some value from it. But honestly, the best thing that came out of that is the sales managers who were distributed geographically and only got to talk to each other like three times a year at, you know, district meetings or something, could actually like communicate back and forth in this virtual environment every day. And just the fact that they were able to like talk to each other and go, oh man, that happens to you. Oh, I totally had that last week. Here's what I did. Yeah. You know, that facilitating those conversations so people can kind of support each other again in that moment of need. Like I need this information right now, and I don't want to go to the training course to find it. And I don't, you know, like I can't go to the training course to find it. It's not available. And I don't want to find the one page in the e-learning on slide 76 that told me the thing. I just need help with this problem right now. That's the really great things that we get out of social and informal learning environments is much more management of complexity, much more management of like the answers changing. So who's got the latest answer? Much more of that, like, how do I get the specific thing that I need right now? So having some strategy around that can help encourage it and can help create spaces for it. And then that becomes a really nice feedback mechanism for the people who are creating the training, because they can go in and see, you know, in the social forum or in the group chat, what things people are concerned about or what places they're having issues or any of those kinds of things. It becomes a nice iterative mechanism. And maybe some of that can be formalized out, because, you know, it is stable, but we didn't know that they needed to know that until we saw them asking those questions.
So, Julie, as a L&D expert, how tactically then do you facilitate that? Is it really a matter of maybe setting up, you said the space, so maybe it's, you know, setting up an hour or two workshops and getting people together and just having open dialogue, or is it creating an online forum, or what does that look like, you know, a little more tactically? How do you actually facilitate that process?
Yeah, this may be a whole separate conversation. There's some good stuff out there around the community development. My favorite resource for that is Amy Jo Kim's book, Community Building for the Web, which talks about how a community, there's a bunch of roles that exist. You know, if you're trying to create a big learning community around the thing, there's different people who are, you know, fulfilling different roles. There's somebody who's kind of greeting newbies and sort of ushering them in. There's some safe places where they can kind of go check stuff out before they have to jump right into the conversation. There's people who are your, you know, gold-plated go-to people who are going to answer, you know, be able to answer lots of questions and who like answering questions, and how do you support them and make sure that they've got good access to be that helpful resource. You know, there's a lot of answers to it. The shortest version of the tactical answer is to ask yourself the question, are any of these conversations happening right now? Can we just go to where they are and support it better? And make sure more people know about it. You know, so if those conversations are happening in the lunchroom, the answer is that one's kind of hard to scale. But I'm doing a lot of stuff in global healthcare right now, and WhatsApp is very much the method that people use. So if we want people to communicate with their sort of equivalent practitioners in other countries, they're all on WhatsApp anyway. So if we create a WhatsApp group for this particular topic, they're going to be in the app. They're much more likely to participate in it than if we create a Facebook group where, you know, most people in the target audience aren't already on Facebook, right, aren't always already using Facebook for things. So, you know, asking the question of how are they communicating now? How are they interacting now? Can we leverage that, but for this topic? You know, if everybody uses some kind of internal message board, then let's create an internal message board. So the best answer is meet them where they are and then just create some space or facilitate it. If you're starting from scratch, both in the idea of like people talking to each other and also the technology platform they're using to talk to each other, then yeah, that's probably a whole podcast conversation all on its own.
Exactly. Julie, what rich insight and what a fun conversation today. And I really appreciate it. And we are certainly would love to have you back on, because I think it's such a, just L&D in general is a rich topic that has certainly a significant place in ERP organizational change. But to close things out for today anyways, my last question for you is, if you're going to give advice to an organization regarding successful, effective, and efficient learning and development, what little golden nugget would you leave with our listeners for today?
Yeah, I mean, I think the hardest thing for a lot of organizations to do, but I think the most valuable, is those small scale tested out, whether it's a small pilot, whether it's a prototype that we try out with things, but just the process of having that kind of tight feedback loop. So one of the questions that I think about is, it's a, like, you know, weather prediction, if it goes beyond about 10 days out, is pretty much useless. We know that, right? So like, what can I test in the next 7 to 10 days that's going to give me some useful insight as we move forward with this plan or this implementation or this thing? What's the quickest and dirtiest way that I could test this out? Can I print out the screen and have people circle everything that they don't understand, so that I know where to focus my training effort on it? can I test this out with five people and then just have a conversation with them about what's working or not working? What's the small, cheap, quick, dirty version of trying some things out quickly? Because, I mean, you know, the kinds of projects that you're talking about, they have these months and months of planning and implementation. And, you know, a decision that was made 12 months ago, you might actually get into the room and try to be training people on it and then find out there's an issue there. So how can I find that issue out in a week and instead of a year? That's the challenge. And I think that's a, you know, an ongoing challenge for most things in most places.
True.
You know, I mean, we hear the mantra of fail fast, but like, what's a literal thing? Like, if I just had this thing I'm trying to figure out and you just asked yourself the question, what could I do in the next week to gather some actual data on this, even if it's pretty informal or it's pretty ugly? But how could I find out something in the next week that would be data that I could feed back into this?
Great advice. Julie, thank you so much for your time today. We really appreciate you sharing your time and your experience with us. Can you tell our listeners how they can get in touch with you?
Yeah. My website is usablelearning.com. And so that's the home base. I'm on Twitter as Usable Learning, and you can find me on LinkedIn. I also have a Facebook group called Design for How People Learn that has about somewhere between 6,000 and 7,000 instructional design folks over in that Facebook group. And that is a lovely place if people have follow-up questions to go ask it, because I'm happy to answer questions over there. But also there's lots of smart people in that space who can also answer questions. And I have one course on the whole designing for attention. Basically, it's called Sticky Learning, and that's at designbetterlearning.com. That's most of the places that I'm at. So, but I'm always happy to talk about this stuff. It's kind of my Nerdy Shop Talk's kind of my favorite thing, so.
Well, what a fun conversation, and your insight is just fantastic. So thank you. And we'll be sure to share out your resources and your contact information as well in our show notes.
All right. Thank you so much.
Yeah. Thank you again. Be well, and we'll talk soon for sure.
All right. Thanks for having me.
You betcha. Thank you.
Thank you for joining us for today's episode of the ERP OCJ podcast. This podcast is intended as a forum to study, share, and discuss ERP organizational change successes and challenges. We discuss the people, process, and technological components of ERP organizational change by drawing on knowledge from extensive research, collaborative learning, and practitioner expertise and experience. We are incredibly grateful to have friends, colleagues, and mentors join us in our podcast as we seek to promote, connect, and foster relationships in the ERP organizational change community and contribute to its success by bringing research and practice closer together. We want to make sure this is the most useful and insightful ERP podcast you listen to, and we'd love your help in doing so by leaving us feedback and a review. A great place to do so is at Apple Podcasts. Just click on the Listen in Apple Podcasts link, then click Ratings and Reviews, and let us know your thoughts. You can get more info about the show, including show notes and episode highlights for this and all of our episodes, by visiting nesselandassociates.com and clicking the podcast option. Please join us again next week as we discuss the latest ERP organizational change research, practice, and stories. And don't forget to follow us on social media, hashtag the ERP OCJ. Thanks again for listening. Have a fantastic week.